Well, coming up, a very interesting talk with Coleman Hughes. I think you'll find it provocative and enlightening as well. And I want to thank the Stereo app for making that possible. And you guys may want to go ahead and just sign up for the Stereo app, because we're going to be having some of these conversations throughout the next coming months. So sign up for that Stereo app and enjoy Coleman Hughes. We are recording live on Stereo. Coleman Hughes is our guest. He's on The Blower. He's a writer and opinion columnist, a 24-year-old young black man. Good to speak to you, Coleman.
Good to be here.
We were speaking about it yesterday on the show, what's going on with the police and police shootings and the black community and the news, and how the news is inflating everything and driving, you know, agitating everyone. And I know you've written about a lot of this, and I know you've discussed a lot of it. So let's talk about it from your perspective as a young black man. What is your take on, for instance, we just had the debates a week ago, and they dedicated a half hour to race relations. Do you have thoughts?
Well, there's an emerging narrative that really, it began before 2012, but it really started picking up steam around 2012 and 13 with Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown in 2014, and has reached probably its apex right now. And what that narrative says is that it's taking your life into your own hands to be a black person in this country, that there is an epidemic of shootings of unarmed black people by the cops, and that this type of thing just doesn't happen to white people.
Right. And obviously,
the fact. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, the mainstream media pushes that narrative hard, and the politicians grab it and run with it. So it is pretty pervasive. And by the way, it's the mainstream media, it's the politicians, and it's the culture. It's the LeBron Jameses, it's the NBA, you know, it's all the cultural icons, the Obamas. They're pushing that theme. So, of course, my 14-year-old white daughter believes it.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyone who raises objections to it, as I have, or anyone who points out the fact that, you know, to begin with, we're talking about 40 to 50 Americans killed in a country of 350 million unarmed every year. Most people, you know, at the BLM protest wouldn't guess the number was that low. I'm not trivializing it. One is too many. I'd love to live in a world where it never happens, but we have to be realistic about the size of the problem to begin with. Then there's the racial aspect. How many of those people are black and how many are white and we just don't hear about? Very few people know the name Tony Timpa, who was caught on video with a cop's knee on his upper back, suffocating to death for 13 minutes. Very similar to the George Floyd case. And, you know, it's on YouTube and it has views, but most people I talk to don't know the name. For every black person that gets killed in one of these situations, there's a white person killed usually the same year. You can find an example that just remains nameless because there's no incentive to promote and amplify those examples.
Well, you know, you know what's going on, and I know what's going on. The problem is most citizens don't know what's going on, but I do, in terms of these stories being cooked and this narrative being presented to us. But I do feel there's some voices finally kind of coming up on the other side, voices like yours or Kanye's or, you know, Candace Owens, or, you know, they're starting to, more black voices are starting to creep up. And by the way, that didn't exist 10 years ago. Do you have thoughts on that?
You know, I assume you're a bit older than me, right? I'm 24. It's hard for me to see if there's been a change in the past 10, 20 years because I'm kind of too young to have observed it. But I do think the moment there's any suffocating orthodoxy, there's always going to be dissenters.
Right.
And people who say, wait a minute, you're trying to, you know, pull the shade over my eyes here. I, you know, and a certain type of personality will always want to go against that orthodoxy.
Yeah, well, we're seeing some of that now, but I think it's because the news media and the politicians have gotten over their skis. Like, they pushed a narrative so hard and it's so distorted now that sane people are going, enough.
Well, I think, you know, it's often how revolutions work, but, you know, people overplay their hands. They get caught up in the frenzy of a moment, and they don't realize the damage that they're causing. For instance, in Minneapolis, when George Floyd died in police custody in late May, everyone said defund the police. You know, people were too afraid to point out the, you know, potential problems with shrinking the police force, the common sense problems that any person off the street would raise, like what if crime goes up and what if the people who suffer are the very same people that the activists are speaking in the name of. Lo and behold, shocker, a few months later, you know, the residents of Minneapolis are suing the city because they don't feel safe, because the police force was essentially cut in half. So this is what happens, is people overplay their hand. They have often what is a legitimate a grievance, which is to say there are certainly cases of police brutality. The police often go unpunished for doing bad things. The police lie to protect one another. All of these things are true, but it's a matter of keeping the problem, having an accurate picture of the problem rather than an inflated one, so that the solution doesn't end up being worse than the problem itself.
What is, so from my perspective, I'm a 56-year-old white man who always played a lot of organized sports and football and that stuff. And I always had a lot of black friends when I was younger, mostly from sports and stuff like that. But we do some sleepovers and hang out a bit and that kind of stuff. I grew up a sort of blue collar guy. My feeling on what's going on now, which is turning black people into victims, I couldn't think of a more destructive practice or theory. And it is not going to work. And it's going to hurt the people you're trying to help. And I don't know why more people aren't crying out about this victim thing, which would destroy an individual, or it will destroy a group. It works universally. You can destroy a kid. When my daughter didn't make the volleyball team 4 years ago, she told me it was because the coach hated her. And I realized she was thinking herself a victim, and I spent a bunch of time convincing her that she wasn't a victim, and now she's a standout volleyball player and very proud of it. If I had gone in on making her victim and explained it's the coach's fault, then she'd probably be slamming drugs somewhere right now. So I can't think of a worse strategy for a people than declaring their victims. But you tell me what you think of that.
Well, it's true, and we all know it from our you know, every well-adjusted person tries not to make friends with people that are constantly whining. You know, when we look for relationships, we look for people that don't have a victim complex. But somehow in politics, common sense gets reversed, and the most important people in the room are the ones that have the worst victim mentality, who get a sense of identity, who wouldn't know who they are if they weren't a victim of something. As you say, we all know at a gut level that there is something unhealthy about this. The thing is, I also don't. So you say you see a lot of it. I think there is a lot of it projected in the media, on college campuses, held up. You know, in the 2% of Americans who account for 80% of political tweets. But in reality, what is happening, I think most black people hate the idea of themselves constantly being victims. They don't live their lives that way. And most black people who are not activists, or elitist or journalist, dislike constantly being cast in the role as a victim. And that, you know, 538.com, which is a pretty rigorous and respected sort of nonpartisan polling website, as far as I understand, released an article last week that said Trump support among young black people, say 30 and below, has gone from 10% to 21% in the past 4 years. Very interesting if true.
Yes.
I don't know if it's true, but if true, it, you know, what I would attribute this to is probably an undercurrent of people who you are not really likely to hear from if you're watching TV or on social media, who are kind of, and black men in particular, who are kind of sick of the constant racism victimhood talk. They want to be successful in life. They want to, you know, conquer whatever their life goals are. And the whole attitude of constantly pointing to the ways in which the world has harmed you, while those things are totally real, and black people suffer racism and, you know, disproportionately, is all true. It's just not a natural way to be, to always be focusing on those things.
I want to mention that if you're just tuning in, we're live coast to coast on stereo. Coleman Hughes is our guest. I was talking to Dr. Drew the other day, yesterday, in fact, about something like voter ID, like this notion that black folk or a percentage of black folk can't get their hands on ID, and that thus is voter suppression. And that's got to be the most insulting thing you could say in 2020, that somebody didn't have access to an ID. If any one of these people, whoever leveled that charge, if their teenage daughter told them, oh, we can't go to Hawaii for vacation this summer, I don't have an ID, they'd yell, what's wrong with you? Go to the DMV and go get an ID. This is nuts. Would any of those people tolerate it with their own family members? Not having an ID in the United States in 2020? It's an absurd and insulting premise, is it not?
No, I agree. I mean, is the idea that, like, black people never buy a bottle of wine or get beer from the liquor store, or any of the various mundane everyday things that we all do that require an ID? I mean, my God, it's pretty patronizing.
I would say that in 2000 and almost 21, in the society and the culture that we've established, especially with all the heightened security everywhere, it would be practically, you would cease to function. You could not function in this society without an ID in this era. And the thought should be, if these people don't have access to IDs, then we got to get an ID mobile and drive it out to them and get them IDs.
Or, you know, if there is a genuine problem in pockets of the country where people don't have a lot of identification, there is an attitude that is more rational and sane to me, which is, okay, if we're getting politically motivated in this community, let's do some work and I'll get some IDs.
It's not
that hard.
Well,
if that is a problem in certain places.
Yeah, the insulting part is that they go, like, it affects people of color, you know, and it's like, why?
Right, so the idea is, instead of that, let's just get rid of the requirement. Right? There's an attitude that if there's any bar that any black person anywhere, for whatever reason, can't pass, then just get rid of the bar. Right. If black kids aren't doing as well as white kids on this test, well, get rid of the test. You know, the San Diego school system recently, I don't know if you saw this in the news, but
I did.
You know, they're going to solve the decades long problem of black kids not getting as good grades on average as the average white kid by getting rid of grades and letting the teacher's discretion decide, you know, who gets good, I hesitate to say grades, but good feedback. You know, of course, it's a bit internally contradictory, because if you're going to say the whole system is racist, then aren't the teachers' subjective opinions racist too? But, you know, they don't think through it very much. And what they essentially want to say to black people is that if you're not doing as well on average as white people, we're just going to, you know, not even tilt the scoreboard in your favor anymore, like affirmative action. We're just going to get rid of the whole game.
Well, it's first off, how does that help? How could you help a group? If you, let's just say you had a gym class and you had a fat kid, and the kid was too fat when they did, this is going to date me, but they used to do something called the rope climb. They had ropes up in the gym. And so the kids,
I did that.
All right, you scurry up the rope. But the fat kid is having trouble making up the rope. He can't make it up the rope because he's fat. Okay, the answer isn't take the rope down. That's their answer. That's their cure for this fat kid. Well, then take the rope down. There, good. Now, we don't have to worry about him not making it to the top of the rope and ringing the bell. There is no rope. And we'll take the ropes down for everybody. How could that possibly help this person's situation? This thing of like, well, young black men are suspended from schools at a higher rate. Okay, stop suspending them. Okay.
Yeah.
Take the rope down.
This is the response. The response people give to that argument is, well, if you look at the long run reasons why that kid was fat, you have to go all the way back hundreds of years and understand the systemic racism disanalogies sort of breaking down. But it's America's fault ultimately that kid ended up at a disadvantage to begin with. That's what they come back with. To which I always say, well, sure, I'll grant all of that for the sake of argument, but all we have to work with is today and tomorrow and the future. So getting rid of the rope for the fat kid, what does that do for him? I can grant for the sake of argument that it's the world's fault or it's somebody's fault. You know, it's the legacy of slavery that he ended up where he did. But if we want to help him, if we want to slim him down, then we have to continue doing all of the things that we know lead to a person becoming healthy. Right? Getting rid of the grading system in San Diego doesn't change the fact, the underlying reality, that black kids are on average less academically prepared. The grades are just a signal of that. You get rid of the grades, you don't get rid of the problem. In fact, you get rid of the indication of the problem, which makes the problem then harder to solve because you simply masked it.
Well, look, yeah, you're right. We're both right. We're both 1,000,000% right, which is the kid could give you a long story about his family's history of diabetes and his mom was the fat woman at the circus and his dad was a long-haul trucker who was morbidly obese. And just like, yeah, we'll talk about the past. We'll talk about Jim Crow. We'll talk about slavery. We'll talk about all that. Granted, it exists and it's true and it affects certain people more than others. But you're still fat and we still need to get you in shape for your sake. It's kind of the politicians doing this. It's really the opposite of what you want a politician to do. You want a politician to solve problems, not to just agree with people and explain to them they're not going to be able to achieve what they wanted to achieve. Chris, do we have a listener comment? And I will tell people, don't sit there silently. You can talk to me live here on Stereo. What's our listener comment?
That's it, right? Just fix the actual problem. It's like we're trying to create other problems and make it a thing. And no one's actually talking about any real issues. Like if it was actually a thing that black people can't get IDs, let's make sure they can get IDs.
Well, it's insane. So let's break down that thought for a second, Coleman. let's forget it's an ID. Let's forget it's let's not call it an ID, right? Let's just call this thing a token. All right. It's a societal token. It's a token that everyone in society has to keep in their pocket or their purse, right? We'll call it a society token. And with this society token, you can fly, you can go through airport security, you can buy liquor, you can check into a hotel, you can get into a building. You go to Manhattan, you can't get into one of those commercial buildings without this. Every single, if a policeman pulls you over, he needs to see the token. Every bit of our society revolves around the societal token that everyone needs to have on them. Otherwise, they can't participate in society. Then some bureaucrat, some government type, some politician says, well, all right, let's vote. And if you vote, you have to present your token. And then the other side says, wait a minute. What about the people without tokens? And you go, well, how many of those people are there? And they go, there are many, and they're black. It's disproportionately black. And then that person says, let's get rid of the voter ID rules. Well, if that person was a problem solver and that person was trying to help the people they represent, they would immediately have all their focus on how do we get those people tokens? Because dropping the rule will get them to vote, but they still can't fly in an airplane and they still can't go to the liquor store and they still can't buy a car or operate a car or walk into a building that requires ID. They're still stifled. So if you want to help those people, let's get them a societal token. Right, Coleman?
No, that's a very good point. I mean, there is disturbingly little actual concern for the problems of black intergenerational poverty.
Right.
It's true. You know, when we see these videos of unarmed black people getting killed by the cops, or white people for that matter, it's almost always in communities that are, you know, that everyone is poor and everyone's parents were poor and everyone's grandparents were poor. This is a problem both in the white and black community and certain pockets of Asian communities too, but it's disproportionately a problem in the black community. However, there's very little discussion about how to actually, you know, increase the human capital of people. How do you actually educate people? How do you actually make them, you know, citizens capable of contributing every bit as much as, you know, one's image of the typical middle-class citizen? There's very little about that. And in fact, there are efforts that are sometimes opposed by the left, like charter schools. You know, there are charter schools in New York in the same building as public schools, taking kids from the same community and, you know, doing marginally better and, you know, getting more kids into college. And, you know, Bernie Sanders and the left in general, it just wages war on charter schools. You know, you're talking about public schools that have been failing kids for decades. And then finally, there's a breath of fresh air. A charter comes in and does something good for, you know, black kids, poor black kids. And they're against it. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it would make sense if you were mobbed up with the teachers' unions and using black people like pawns. Then it would make sense, right? Because that's exactly what it's exactly what they're doing. That the school choice thing and the charter school choice, charter schools and school choice, is the most obvious example that they don't give a shit about black people. They're using them for their votes, and they're also in bed with the teachers' unions. Because think about it. The same people who want to abolish school choice are the same ones that are constantly complaining about how the school system is failing the inner city black child. So you are complaining about this problem. All these people on the left, the first thing they say, like, these inner city schools, they're failing. They're failing these kids. The schools are failing their kids. Okay. Then someone says, well, I have an alternative. Why don't we do charter schools or vouchers or school choice? Because statistically, the kids do much better in those environments than they do in the failing schools you're speaking about. And then you say, no, we got to abolish that. Well, what else do you need to know? What else do you need to know? That's all you need to know about those people. They never stop crowing about the poor inner city kids. As soon as you come up with a solution, they're not down with it because they get their money from the teachers' unions. So what else do you need to know? Do they really care about the young, poor black kid in the inner city? I'm guessing they don't, because if they did, they'd be for school choice and vouchers.
I think they think they care.
I wonder if they even think that.
A lot of politics is about the politics of race is about the management and the psychodrama of white guilt.
Yeah.
And how different people deal with it differently. And a lot of stuff that is said in the name of black people and in the name of fighting racism is really an internal battle that a lot of white people are facing with how they should feel about the fact that they're white and that black people on average are poorer and suffer more racism. And there's an enormous guilt that some white people feel and others don't. And that gets expressed in all kinds of bizarre ways that only have a tangential relationship to helping those black people who need it.
Yeah. We have a, I want to know about your story and your history and how you arrived where you arrived. We have a question for you. I want to tell everyone we are recording this live on Stereo with Coleman Hughes. We have a question queued up for Coleman.
Coleman, I'm a big fan of yours, and I'm very impressed by how you are so able to keep a calm head in such heated discussion. Do you have any recommendations for people just trying to have discussions with friends and family to keep a cool head? Thank you.
I highly recommend mindfulness meditation. There's a lot of hype around it, but that hype is tracking something real, which is that managing your own emotions is a skill like any other skill. And when you feel anger swell up, a righteous anger of knowing you're correct and wanting to lord it over the person you're speaking to, that is an emotion that's not always helpful, not always useful. And you can get better at feeling that emotion, letting it pass, and then responding calmly.
There you go. Thanks for the question. So, Coleman, how did you grow up, and how did you arrive at the place you're at today?
I grew up in a very diverse and nice suburb called Montclair, New Jersey, 20 or 30 minutes outside of the city.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a New Yorkian Marxist from the South Bronx. My father was middle class, grew up middle class black in Ohio and was kind of an Ayn Rand libertarian. Mm-hmm. They used to debate all the time. So I was very used to having different takes on politics.
Mm-hmm.
And as a kid, I was effortlessly friends with black kids and white kids and Jewish kids and never thought anything of it. Until I was about 16 or 17, when I started hearing about all of these ideas that I had never sort of encountered before, white privilege, systemic racism, internalized oppression, and I sort of realized my blackness was in this ideology, my being black was this special thing, this thing that made me powerful, you know, and unique. And this is what I think kind of my whole generation, the ideology my whole generation is told, is that if you have anything, if you're anything other than a straight white male, you can tap into that and wield it as a kind of power and social status. And I was immersed in that culture as someone who grew up in blue America in the you know, aughts and 2010s. And I just came to realize how disturbing and unhealthy the whole dynamic is. It sets up a strange inverted hierarchy. Instead of trying to fight white supremacy with the kind of colorblind anti-racism that I lived as a kid, it tries to strangely invert all the hierarchies of the past and say, as Douglas Murray put it, you know, women are equal, but also somehow better. You know, black people are exactly the same as white people, but also, if we're having a conversation about race, my opinion supersedes yours because I have lived experience that you don't have. So in a sense, I'm better. And the notion of inverting hierarchies rather than really committing ourselves to understanding that skin color is superficial. It's the dumbest thing in the world to base an assessment of anyone's character on. And I think I came to be disturbed that we were losing that Martin Luther King approach to the question of race.
Yeah.
So that's how I, you know, came to my opinion, more or less.
I really do worry about this new sort of racial world we're living in, at least in our country, and how we've somehow decided that the best cure for racism is to never stop talking about it. You know, it always makes me laugh when people talk about, we have to have a dialogue about race. It's like, that's all we do. That's all we do is talk. What do you mean we have to have that? You dedicated 40 minutes of the presidential debate to talking about race. We never got to foreign policy.
The other thing that gets me is that we have to finally have a reckoning about our history.
Right.
I was watching Roots in fifth grade.
I saw Roots when it aired originally, and I watched all, was it eight parts? I think it was eight parts. Either way, I watched it live.
Yeah. Right. So I'm not saying that one textbook in Texas didn't call slaves immigrants, and I'm not saying that's not messed up. I think that stuff, America is a huge country.
Right.
There are enormous differences from location to location. That's one difficulty about this conversation. But overwhelmingly, if you look at how other countries in the world, you know, Germany excluded, tend to deal with their histories, we're actually among the best at recognizing our past sins. That sounds incredibly shocking to people, but go to Turkey and ask them about the Armenian genocide, you know, much more recent than slavery. And, you know, you can't say a single word about it. Go to China and see how they deal with their past sins. In America, for better or for worse, and it's not to say we're perfect, it's the type of country where you can have a Roots. Right. You can have a book like People's History of the United States be a bestseller in the 80s.
Right.
You can have the 1619 Project. And there's a lot of stuff to criticize in all this. But the mere fact that it exists in the mainstream suggests that we're actually pretty open to talking about the past, and we do quite a lot of it.
Well, we have a two-term black president finish as one of the most beloved figures in our country and then explain to us why our country is inherently racist with his wife, who's the second most popular person in the country. It's condescending. And yes, it doesn't exist nearly to the extent that the news agencies and the Obamas and everyone else try to make it out to be. But, you know, I was thinking about all of this white fragility business and all these idiots having to show up to everyone's corporation and separate people and explain to them what a microaggression is or about white privilege or whatever. I'm curious to get your take. If I was a black employee of this company and the middle-aged broad came to the company to sit everyone down and explain to them why white people were bad, I would be wildly uncomfortable with that as a black person. I would feel it was condescending. I feel it was strange. And I would also feel like people would be looking at me differently after this symposium.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of black people, if they encounter the whole white fragility trope, would instinctively either not understand it or be kind of repelled by it and ask the obvious question, so what does all this have to do with helping black people? Because it seems, as I said before, like it's a lot of, controversial, novel, and strange ideas about how white people should feel about themselves and flagellate or themselves or not. But, her one of her arguments is that if you and I are talking because you're white and I'm black, there's a whole range of normal behaviors that you should not exhibit in this conversation, like withdrawal or argumentation or pushback. You're literally not supposed to, on her view, argue back with a black person on the topic of race.
Well,
and if I call you a racist right now, she says it countless times in the book, there's only one acceptable response, which is enthusiastically agreeing with me. And if you don't, then you're exhibiting white fragility.
Well, I'm not. That's insane.
Do you think you and I could possibly become friends?
Right.
If you were to actually adhere to those rules.
It's insulting to both parties. I want to know what you know about that book. If you're just tuning in, we're live coast to coast on Stereo with Coleman Hughes. How much have you dug into that White Fragility book? Ugh. I mean, the fact that that thing's a bestseller and that she's getting
very
paid
closely.
$20,000 a pop to go from corporation to corporation to make white people feel bad and black people feel embarrassed, that is nuts. We have jumped the shark. And it's mostly because, let me talk about white people for a second. White people are cowards. They're cowards. They're so scared of being called a racist that they'll just agree with anything just because they don't want to be taken out to the public square and flogged or attacked on Twitter or whatever it is. So white people don't think white people are bad. White people don't think white people are racist. Most people, you take my family. My family's from Italy. My wife's family's from Italy. They came here for nothing, with nothing in their pockets, and it was well after racism. So I have no connection to racism in terms of my family. So I'm not going to apologize for it. But most people are so frightened of being called a racist. All white people are. They cave immediately. And that created the climate we're in now. But what do you know about Robin DiAngelo and white fragility?
So I've read the book very closely. And before I tell you why I think it's awful and actually racist, I want to just explain its appeal a little bit. Because at minimum, you have to be interested. Why is this thing so damn popular? It's been on the bestsellers list for 110 weeks. That rarely ever happens. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think it works a little bit like Original Sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you say, white people are terrified more than almost anything else of the idea that they might actually be racist or that they might be accused of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And so what DiAngelo does, which is kind of brilliant, is to say, yes, you're racist. You are racist, but it's not your fault. Society created you racist without your consent. You couldn't have been built otherwise. Very much like Original Sin in the sense that God created you a sinner. You're a sinner already, and it's not your fault. There's something very soothing about that to people because they feel like they're not being let off the hook, but they kind of are. And that's how she hooks white people.
Mm.
And then once she's hooked you, she jams this critical race theory down your throat. This is what you have to do. This is the never-ending program of redemption that you have to engage in, and it never ends, and you'll never be cured of the thing, but you have to do it, or else you're going to hell.
Right. So it has a very religious kind of flavor to it, doesn't it?
It does. It does. But the problem is that her program is, there's no evidence it actually makes people less racist, for one thing.
Well,
sorry,
Coleman. Just let me jump in.
Black racist thing.
Can I just jump in? How would you make someone less racist if they were just racist? You know what I mean?
I'm not sure that there is a way. I think we haven't found it, and I don't think all things are possible. Some people think you can just snap your fingers and change someone's psychology, but I'm not sure that. I think frankly, the way to make people less racist is to do what Martin Luther King did, right? To make an argument, to have protests that are completely nonviolent, that demonstrate their seriousness, to show the horrors of racism, to show the body of Emmett Till, to show the hoses turned on black protesters. And the truth ends up changing hearts to some degree. But the hearts that don't get changed, you can't just reach in there with a workshop and change them.
Well,
that's not how it works.
No, I think in a weird way, the power to change also lies in the person who may be the victim, in the sense that if I had a neighbor, and I had a Vietnamese neighbor, and that neighbor was a douche, then I'd go, I don't like that guy. And then at some point, it would go, I don't like the Vietnamese guy who lives next door to me. And then at some point, it'd be, I don't like Vietnamese guys, right? But if that person next to me was the greatest neighbor in the world, then I would have a different opinion of that person. So I don't think you can push it at something. There's a lot of it is both parties. It's a kind of a two-way, it's a two-way street. It's the person, you know, Robin DiAngelo just wants to round up all the white people who are at the workplace and tell them not to be racist or explain to them how not to be racist. I don't know how that's, I don't think it's possible to do that.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think it's possible either. And they're, you know, they run tests about whether these things worked or whether they even reduce implicit bias, which is also a kind of shaky measure. And they find it doesn't even do that.
No, of course. Look, it works as well. Her plan works as well for white people not being racist as the get rid of the voter ID laws do for getting black people IDs. Neither one. They're both equally as ineffective. We got a question up here, and don't sit silently. You can talk to me live here on stereo. We have a listener comment, an Asian listener, Sam Kim. Sam?
Do you think Asians have white privilege? We seem to enjoy all the benefits, but we're also good at math.
Asians do better than white people in this country. I think Eastern Indians at the top, Asians probably next. Whites, I think whites are in third place in this country. Then it's probably Hispanic and black or some version of that. But what is your take on Asians? See, I have a theory about Asians. Asians don't get caught up in all this bullshit. The Asians just fucking put their head down and go to work. And that's why they're kicking everyone's ass. They don't have time for this. It doesn't feel satiating for them. They just go. And they're doing better per capita than white people. But it's interesting. They never enter the conversation because they don't want to be in the conversation. They want to just put their head down and kick ass. Thoughts?
There is definitely a lot of truth to that. I think a lot of Asian immigrants come, especially, you know, if you come from China or another country, you might be coming from a country that has a different political culture, a culture where you don't, not everyone feels like their political opinion is the most important thing, like we all do here. And they bring that culture with them. At the same time, there have been some groups of sort of small but growing protests among Asian immigrants, especially not second generation or third, but sort of fresh immigrants, that are very upset that, you know, tests in New York to get into the elite schools might no longer be objective, right? Mm-hmm. That they might take points off of your total application score if you're Asian to try to get into Stuyvesant or Bronx Science. And they understandably feel like, hey, we came to this country because what you guys advertise is that everyone plays by the same rules, and we want to play to win. And I came from, you know, I came a long way. I came from China to do this, and now you're telling me because I'm Asian, I'm going to be penalized even more than white people are just because we're doing so well as a group? And they see something wrong with that. But I think over time, Asian immigrants, second generation and third generation, sort of assimilate to the American culture of pretending there's something normal about racially rigging the test. So you see less political, less complaints about discrimination among Asians that have been more assimilated.
So lastly, Coleman, if you had a magic wand and you could just wave it in front of the black community, what would you wish for?
I think probably more less punishment of so-called race traitors would be a very good thing.
Are you an Uncle Tom? Are you a race traitor?
Apparently, I've been told this. Less punishment of people like Kanye or myself or Glenn Lowry or Thomas Chatterton Williams or John McWhorter or other people.
How insulting is it that you're not considered black by the left if you have an opinion that differs from theirs?
Well, yeah, I mean, they do this with you know, you're not gay if you happen to be a gay conservative. You know, black, gay, and female, they become, instead of identities, they become a kind of politics in themselves, which is very strange.
Yeah, it's got, you're a brave man, 24. You know, I'm old, I can take it, but you got your whole life ahead of you, kid, so... God bless you for fighting the fight. The podcast, Conversations with Coleman, it's available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify as well, and the website, ColemanHughes.org. I want to thank Stereo for hosting this conversation. We have a last comment.
Adam Carolla, wow, I am surprised and happy as hell to see you on the app. I hope to someday be able to pop on here with you. Welcome to Stereo, brother.
That could have been a distant uncle of yours, Coleman. So I want to thank the Stereo app for taking care of us. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Coleman Hughes saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. Thanks to Stereo for providing our live interview with Coleman Hughes. Download the Stereo app today and pick up Adam's new book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. Get all the links at adamcarolla.com.